Ruth's First Wedding. Alan Albright and Ruth Cole were married over the long Thanksgiving weekend, which they spent at Ruth's house in Vermont. Hannah, together with a bad boyfriend, was a weekend-long house guest, as was Eddie O'Hare, who gave the bride away. Hannah was Ruth's maid of honor. With Minty's help, Eddie had identified that George Eliot passage about marriage. Ruth wanted Hannah to read it at her wedding. Of course, Minty couldn't resist a small lecture upon his success in locating the passage.
"You see, Edward," Minty informed his son, "a passage of this kind, which is a summation, both in its content and in its tone, is certain to be an opening passage to a chapter, or, more likely, a concluding passage. And as it suggests some deeper finality, it is more likely a passage to be found near the end of a book than it is to be found near the beginning."
"I see," Eddie said. "What book is it from?"
"The hint of irony gives it away," Minty intoned. "That and its bittersweet quality. It's like a pastoral, but more than a pastoral."
"Which novel is it, Dad?" Eddie begged his father.
"Why, it's Adam Bede, Edward,"
the old English teacher told his son.
"And it's well suited for your friend's wedding, which is a November wedding, the same month Adam Bede himself was married to Dinah. On a rimy morning in parting November," Minty quoted from memory. "That's from the first sentence of the last chapter, not counting the epilogue," the old English teacher added.
Eddie felt exhausted, but he'd identified the passage as Ruth had asked him to. At Ruth's wedding, Hannah read from George Eliot with a lack of conviction, but the words themselves were alive for Ruth. "What greater thing is there for two human souls than to feel that they are joined for life, to strengthen each other in all labor, to rest on each other in all sorrow, to minister to each other in all pain, to be one with each other in silent, unspeakable memories at the moment of the last parting?"
What greater thing is there indeed? Ruth wondered. She thought she had only begun to love Alan. She believed she was already loving him more than she'd ever loved anyone else, except her dad.
The civil ceremony, which was conducted by a local justice of the peace, was held in Ruth's favorite bookstore in Manchester, Vermont. The booksellers, a man and his wife, who were old friends of Ruth's, were kind enough to close their store for a couple of hours on one of the busiest shopping weekends of the year. After the wedding, the bookstore opened its doors to business as usual, but there seemed to be more than the expected numbers of book buyers waiting to be served. Among them were some curiosity seekers. As the new Mrs. Albright, which Ruth Cole would never be called, left the store on Alan's arm, she averted her eyes from the bystanders. "If there are any journalists, I'll handle them," Hannah had whispered to Ruth. Eddie was looking all around, for Marion, of course.
"Is she here? Do you see her?" Ruth asked.
But Eddie just shook his head. Ruth was looking for someone else, too. She was half expecting that Alan's ex-wife would show up, although Alan had scoffed at her fears. The subject of no children had been a bitter one between Alan and his former wife, but their divorce had been a joint decision. Harassment was not a part of his ex-wife's nature, Alan had said. On that busy Thanksgiving weekend, they'd had to park at some distance from the bookstore. As they passed a pizza restaurant and a store that sold candles, Ruth realized that they were being followed. Notwithstanding that Hannah's bad boyfriend had the appearance of a bodyguard, someone was following the small wedding party. Alan took Ruth's arm and hurried her along the sidewalk. They were now near the parking lot. Hannah kept turning to look at the elderly woman who was following them, but the woman was not one to be stared down.
"She's not a journalist," Hannah said. "Fuck her, she's just some old lady," Hannah's bad boyfriend said.
"I'll handle this," said Eddie O'Hare. But this older woman was immune to Eddie's charms.
"I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to her," the elderly woman told Eddie. She was pointing at Ruth.
"Look, lady, it's her wedding day. Take a fucking hike," Hannah said. Alan and Ruth stopped walking and faced the old lady, who was out of breath from hurrying after them.
"It's not my ex-wife," Alan whispered, but Ruth knew this as surely as she knew that the old woman wasn't her mother.
"I wanted to see your face," the elderly lady said to Ruth. In her own way, she was as nondescript as Roya's murderer. She was just another older woman who'd let herself go, and with that thought, even before the woman spoke again, Ruth suddenly knew who she was. Who else but a widow for the rest of her life would be so inclined to let herself go?
"Well, now you've seen my face," Ruth told her. "What next?"
"I want to see your face again when you're a widow," the angry widow said. "I can't wait for that."
"Hey," Hannah told the elderly lady, "by the time she's a widow, you'll be dead. You look like you're dying already."
Hannah took Ruth's arm out of Alan's hand and started pulling her toward their car.
"Come on, baby, it's your wedding day."
Alan briefly glared at the old woman. Then he followed Ruth and Hannah. Hannah's bad boyfriend, although he looked like an enforcer, was actually an ineffectual wimp. He just scuffed his feet and glanced at Eddie. And Eddie O'Hare, who'd never met an older woman who couldn't or wouldn't be charmed, thought he would try again with the angry widow, who was staring after Ruth as if she were memorizing the moment.
"Wouldn't you agree that weddings are sacred, or that they should be?" Eddie began. "Aren't they among those days that we are meant to remember all our lives?"
"Oh, yes, I agree," the old widow said eagerly. "She'll surely remember this day. When her husband's dead, she'll remember it more than she wants to. There's not an hour that goes by when I don't remember my wedding day."
"I see," Eddie said. "Can I walk you to your car?"
"No, thank you, young man," the widow told him.
Eddie, defeated by her righteousness, turned away and hurried after the wedding party. All of them were hurrying, perhaps because of the rawness of the November weather. There was a small dinner party in the late afternoon. The local booksellers came, and Kevin Merton, Ruth's caretaker, with his wife. Alan and Ruth had arranged no honeymoon. As for the new couple's plans, Ruth had told Hannah that they would probably use the Sagaponack house more frequently than they would get to Vermont. Eventually, they would have to choose between Long Island and New England, which, once they had a child, would be an obvious choice, Ruth had said. When the child was old enough to go to school, she would want the child to be in Vermont.
"And when will you know if there's going to be a kid?" Hannah had asked Ruth.
"When I get pregnant."
"Or when I don't," Ruth had replied. "But are you trying?" Hannah had asked.
"We're going to start trying after the new year."
"So soon," Hannah said. "You're not wasting any time."
"I'm 36, Hannah. I've wasted enough time."
The fax machine in the Vermont house rang throughout her wedding day, and Ruth kept leaving her dinner party to check the messages. Congratulations from her foreign publishers, for the most part. There was a sweet message from Martin and Sylvia in Amsterdam. "Wim will be broken-hearted," Sylvia had written. Ruth had asked Martin to keep her informed of any developments in the case of the murdered prostitute. Martin had told Ruth that there was no news about the prostitute's murder. The police weren't talking about it. "Did she have any children?" Ruth had earlier faxed Martin. "I wonder if that poor prostitute had any children." But there had been nothing in the news about the prostitute's daughter either. Ruth had got on an airplane. She'd crossed an ocean, and what had happened in Amsterdam had all but vanished. Only in the dark, when she lay awake, did she feel the touch of a dress on a hanger or smell the leather of the halter top that had hung in Roya's closet.
"You're going to tell me when you're pregnant, aren't you?" Hannah asked Ruth when they were doing the dishes.
You're not going to try to keep that a secret, too, are you?
I have no secrets, Hannah, Ruth lied.
You're the biggest secret I know, Hannah told her. The only way I know what's going on with you is the only way everyone else knows it. I just have to wait and read your next book.
But I don't write about myself, Hannah, Ruth reminded her.
So you say, Hannah said. Of course I'll tell you when I'm pregnant, Ruth said, changing the subject. You'll be the first to know after Alan.
When she went to bed with Alan that night, Ruth felt at peace with herself. But she also felt exhausted.
Are you okay? Alan asked her.
Very okay, Ruth told him.
You seem tired, Alan said.
I am tired, Ruth admitted.
You seem different somehow, Alan told her.
Well, I'm married to you, Alan, Ruth replied.
That's different, isn't it?
By the end of the first week of January 1991, Ruth would be pregnant, which would be different, too.
Boy, that was fast, Hannah would remark. Tell Alan not every guy his age is still shooting live ammunition.
Graham Cole Albright, 7 pounds, 10 ounces, was born in Rutland, Vermont, on October 3rd, 1991. The boy's birthday coincided with the first anniversary of German reunification. Although she hated to drive, Hannah drove Ruth to the hospital. She'd been staying with Ruth for the final week of Ruth's pregnancy because Alan was working in New York. He drove to Vermont on the weekends. It was 2 a.m. when Hannah left Ruth's house for the hospital in Rutland, which was about a 45-minute drive. Hannah had called Alan as they were leaving for the hospital. The baby wasn't born until after 10 a.m. Alan arrived in plenty of time for the actual delivery. As for the baby's namesake, Graham Greene, Alan remarked that he hoped his little Graham would never share the novelist's reputed habit of frequenting brothels. Ruth, who for more than a year had been bogged down near the end of Volume 1 of The Life of Graham Greene, felt a far greater anxiety for one of Greene's other habits, his inclination to travel to the world's trouble spots in search of first-hand experience. This was nothing Ruth would wish upon her little Graham, nor would she ever again seek such experiences for herself. After all, she'd seen a prostitute murdered by her customer, and it appeared that the murderer had got away with it. Ruth's novel in progress would suffer a year-long hiatus. She moved with her baby boy back to Sagaponack, which meant that Conchita Gomez could be Graham's nanny. This also made the weekends easier for Alan. He could take the jitney or the train from New York to Bridgehampton in half the time it took him to drive from the city to Vermont. He could also work on the train. In Sagaponack, Alan used Ted's former workroom for an office. Ruth claimed that the room still smelled of squid ink or of a decomposing star-nosed mole or of the Polaroid print coater. The photographs were gone now, although Ruth said she could still smell them, too. But what could she smell or otherwise detect in her office on the second floor of the barn? The remodeled Sagaponack squash court, which Ruth chose as her workroom. The ladder and trap door had been replaced by a normal flight of stairs and a normal door. Ruth's new office had baseboard heating. There was a window where the dead spot on the front wall of the squash court had been. When the novelist sat typing on her old-fashioned typewriter, or, as she more often did, writing by hand on the long yellow pads of lined paper, she never heard the reverberation that the squash ball used to make against the telltale tin. And the tea on the former court, which she'd been taught to take possession of, as if her life depended on it, was carpeted now. Ruth couldn't see it. She could smell, from time to time, the exhaust fumes from the cars that were still parked on the ground floor of the old barn. it wasn't a smell that bothered her.
"You're a weird one," Hannah would say to her again. "It would give me the creeps to work here."
But at least until Graham was old enough to go to preschool, the Sagaponack house would be fine for Ruth. It was fine for Alan and for Graham, too. They would go to Vermont for the summers when the Hamptons were overrun and when Alan didn't so much mind the long drive from the city and back. It was a 4-hour drive from New York to Ruth's house in Vermont. Ruth would worry, then, about Alan driving such a distance at night. There were deer on the roads and drunken drivers. But she had little else to worry about. She was happily married, and for the first time, she loved her life. Like any new mother, especially like any new older mother, Ruth worried about her baby. She'd been unprepared for how much she was going to love him. But Graham was a healthy child. Ruth's anxieties for him were entirely the product of her imagination. At night, for example, when she thought that Graham's breathing was strange or different, or worse, when she couldn't hear him breathing, she would rush from the master bedroom to the nursery, which had been her own bedroom as a child. There, Ruth would often curl up on the rug beside the crib. She kept a pillow and a quilt in Graham's closet for such occasions. On the weekends, Alan would often find her on the floor of the nursery in the mornings, sound asleep beside her sleeping child. And when Graham was no longer sleeping in a crib, and he was old enough to climb in and out of his bed by himself, Ruth would lie in the master bedroom, hearing her child's feet padding across the floor of the master bathroom on his way to her. It was exactly how Ruth had crossed that bathroom floor as a child, padding on her way to her mother's bed, no, to her father's bed, more often, except for that memorable night, when she'd surprised her mother with Eddie. This is closure, if there ever is closure, the novelist thought to herself. Something had come full circle. Here was an ending and a beginning. Eddie O'Hare was Graham's godfather. Hannah Grant was the boy's godmother, a more responsible and reliable godmother than one might have thought. And on those nights when she lay curled on the nursery floor, listening to her child breathe, Ruth Cole would be thankful for her good luck. Roya's murderer, who had clearly heard the sound of someone trying not to make a sound, had not found her. Ruth often thought of him. She not only wondered who he was, and if he had a habit of killing prostitutes, she wondered if he'd read her novel, for she'd seen him take Roya's copy of Not for Children. Maybe he'd only wanted the book as a place to keep his Polaroid picture of Roya safe from harm. On those nights, curled on the rug beside Graham's crib, later his bed, Ruth surveyed the dimly lit nursery in the feeble nightlight. She saw the familiar part in the window curtain. Through the narrow slit, a black streak of night sky was visible, sometimes starry, sometimes not. Usually, it was a catch in Graham's breathing that would make Ruth get up off the floor and look closely at her sleeping son. Then she would peek through the part in the curtain to see if the mole man was where she half expected him to be, curled asleep on the window ledge, with some of the pink tentacles of his star-shaped nose pressed against the glass. The mole man was never there, of course. Yet Ruth would sometimes wake with a start because she was sure she'd heard him wheeze. It was only Graham who'd made a curious sigh in his sleep. Then Ruth would fall back to sleep, often wondering why her mother hadn't made an appearance now that her father was dead. Didn't she want to see the baby, Ruth would wonder? Not to mention me. It made her so angry that she tried to stop wondering. And because Ruth was often alone with Graham in the Sagaponack house, at least on those nights when Alan was staying in the city, there were those times when the house made peculiar sounds. There was the mouse crawling between the walls sort of sound, and the sound like someone trying not to make a sound sort of sound. and the whole range of sounds between those sounds. The opening of the door in the floor sort of sound. And the sound that the mole man made when he held his breath. He was out there somewhere, Ruth knew. He was still waiting for her. In the mole man's eyes, she was still a little girl. Trying to sleep, Ruth could see the mole man's small, vestigial eyes, the furry dents in his furry face. As for Ruth's new novel, it was waiting for her, too. One day she wouldn't be a new mother, and she would write again. So far, she'd written only about 100 pages of My Last Bad Boyfriend. She hadn't yet come to the scene when the boyfriend persuades the woman writer to pay a prostitute to watch her with a customer. Ruth was still working up to it. That scene was waiting for her, too. Part 3. Fall, 1995. The Civil Servant. Sergeant Harry Hoekstra, formerly Hofdagent, or almost a Sergeant Hoekstra, was avoiding the task of cleaning out his desk. His office on the second floor of the District 2 police station overlooked the Varmustraat. Harry, while he did nothing about his desk, which had never been cleaned out before, distracted himself by regarding the changes in the street. For the Varmustraat, like the rest of the red light district, had undergone some changes. As a street cop who was presently looking forward to an early retirement, Sergeant Hoekstra knew that very little had ever escaped his attention. Opposite the station, there'd once been a flower shop, the Jemy, but the shop had moved to the corner of the Enge Kerksteeg. Still within Harry's view was a place called La Paella, and an Argentinian restaurant called Tango, but the Jemy flower shop had been replaced by Sani's Bar. Were Harry as prescient as many of his colleagues thought he was, he might have seen sufficiently into the future to know that within a year of his retirement, Sani's Bar would itself be replaced by the unfortunately named Café Pimpelmay. But even the powers of a good policeman do not extend into the future with such specific detail. Like many men who choose to retire early, Harry Hoekstra believed that most of the changes in his neighborhood of business were not changes for the better. It was in 66 when the hashish had first come to Amsterdam in noticeably larger amounts. In the 70s, the heroin came. First with the Chinese, but by the end of the Vietnam War, the Chinese had lost the heroin market to the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. Many of the addicted prostitutes were couriers for the heroin. Nowadays, more than 60% of the addicts were known to the health department, and there were Dutch police officers stationed in Bangkok. But more than 70% of the prostitutes in the red light district were illegal aliens. Basically, there was no keeping track of the illegals. As for the cocaine, it had come from Colombia via Suriname in small planes. The Surinamese brought it to the Netherlands in the late 60s and early 70s. The Surinamese prostitutes had not been that much of a problem, and their pimps had caused only a little trouble. The problem had been the cocaine. Now the Colombians themselves brought it, but the Colombian prostitutes were not a problem either, and their pimps made even less trouble than the Surinamese pimps. In his more than 39 years of service on the Amsterdam police force, 35 of which he'd spent in Devalen, Harry Hoekstra had only once had a gun pointed at him. It was Max Perk, a Surinamese pimp, who'd pointed the gun at Harry, which had prompted Harry to show Max his gun. Had there been a shootout of the quick-draw variety, Harry would have lost. Max had drawn his gun first. But the display of weapons was more in the nature of a show of force, which Harry had won. Harry's gun was a Walther 9mm. "It's made in Austria," Harry had explained to the pimp from Suriname.
The Austrians really know their guns. This will blow a bigger hole in you than yours will blow in me, and mine will blow more holes in you in a hurry."
Whether this was true or not, Max Perk had put down his gun. Yet notwithstanding Sergeant Hoekstra's personal experiences with the Surinamese, he believed that the days ahead were fairly certain to be worse. Criminal organizations were bringing young women from the former Soviet bloc into Western Europe. Thousands of women from Eastern Europe were now working involuntarily in the red-light districts of Amsterdam, Brussels, Frankfurt, Zurich, Paris, and other Western European cities. The owners of nightclubs, striptease joints, peep shows, and brothels commonly traded these young women for a fee. As for the Dominicans, the Colombians, the Brazilians, and the Thais, most of these young women knew what they were coming to Amsterdam for. They understood what they were going to do. But the young women from Eastern Europe often were under the impression that they were going to be waitresses in respectable restaurants. They were students and shop girls and housewives before they'd accepted these misleading job offers in the West. Among these newcomers to Amsterdam, the window prostitutes were the best off. But now the girls in the windows were being undersold by the girls on the streets. Everyone was more desperate for work. The prostitutes whom Harry had known the longest were either retiring or threatening to retire. Not that prostitutes didn't often threaten to retire. It was a business of what Harry called short-term thinking. The hookers were always telling him that they were stopping next month or next year. Or else one of the women would say, "I'm taking next winter off anyway." And now, more than ever, many prostitutes had admitted to Harry that they'd had what they called a moment of doubt. This meant that they'd let in the wrong man. There were simply more wrong men than there used to be.
Sergeant Hoekstra remembered one Russian girl who'd accepted a so-called waitressing job at the Cabaret Antoine. The Cabaret Antoine was no restaurant, it was a brothel, and the brothel owner had immediately seized the Russian girl's passport. She was told that even if a customer didn't want to use a condom, she couldn't refuse to have sex with him, unless she wanted to find herself out on the street. She'd had a phony Czech passport anyway, and she soon found a seemingly sympathetic client, an older man, who procured another phony Czech passport for her, but by then her name had been changed. In the brothel, they'd reduced her name to Vratna, because her real name was too difficult to pronounce. And her first 2 months of salary were withheld, because her so-called debts to the brothel had to be deducted from her earnings. The alleged debts were described to her as agency fees, taxes, food, and rent. Shortly before the brothel was raided by the police, Vratna accepted a loan from her sympathetic client. The older man paid her share of the rent for a window room, which she used with two other girls from Eastern Europe, and so she became a window prostitute. As for the loan, which Vratna could never repay, her seeming sympathizer became her most privileged client. He visited her often. Naturally, she charged him no fee. In fact, he'd become her pimp without her even knowing it. Soon, she was paying him half her earnings from her other clients. As Sergeant Hoekstra later thought of him, he was her not-so-sympathetic client. He was a retired executive named Paul de Vries, who'd taken up pimping for these illegal Eastern European girls as a kind of sport and pastime. It was no more than an amusing game for him to fuck young girls, at first for a price, but later for free. Eventually, of course, they would be paying him, and he would still be fucking them. One Christmas morning, one of only a few recent Christmases that Harry had not taken off, Harry had ridden his bicycle through the new snow in Dvalin. It was very early, and Harry had wanted to see if any of the prostitutes were working.
He'd had an idea, not unlike Ruth Cole's, that in the new snow of a Christmas morning, even the red light district might look pristine. But Harry had been, uncharacteristically, more sentimental than that. For those few girls who might be working in their window rooms on Christmas morning, Harry had bought some simple presents. Nothing fancy or expensive, just some chocolates and a fruitcake, and not more than half a dozen Christmas tree ornaments. Harry knew that Vratna was religious, or at least she'd told him that she was, and for her, just in case she was working, he'd bought a present of slightly more value. Still, he'd paid only 10 guilders for it in a second-hand jewelry shop. It was a cross of Lorraine, which the salesgirl had told him was especially popular with young people of unconventional tastes. It was a cross with 2 cross pieces, the upper shorter than the lower. It had been snowing hard, and by 7 o'clock there were almost no visible footprints in Dvalin. Some tracks surrounded the one-man urinal by the old church, but in the untracked snow on Vratna's small street, the Oude Kennisteeg, there were no footprints at all. And Harry had been relieved to see that Vratna wasn't working. Her window was dark, her curtain closed, the red light off. He was about to ride on with his rucksack of humbly inspired Christmas presents when he noticed that the door to Vratna's window room was not properly closed. Some snow had drifted inside, and the snow made it difficult for Harry to close the door. He'd not meant to look into her room, but he needed to open the door wider before he could close it. He was scuffing the snow off the threshold with his foot. It was not the best weather for his running shoes, when he saw the young woman hanging from the ceiling light fixture. With the door to the street open, the wind rushed in and caused her hanging body to sway. Harry stepped inside and closed the door against the blowing snow. She'd hanged herself that morning, probably a little after the first light of day. She was 23. She was dressed in her old clothes, what she'd worn to the West for her new waitressing job. Because she was not dressed, which is to say, undressed, as a prostitute, Harry hadn't at first recognized her. Vratna had put on all her jewelry, too, what there was of it. It would have been superfluous for Harry to have given the girl another cross. There were 6 crosses around her neck. There were nearly as many crucifixes, too. Harry didn't touch her or anything in her room. He merely noted that from the chafe marks at her throat, not to mention the damage to the ceiling plaster, she must not have suffocated right away. She had thrashed for a while. A musician rented the apartment above Ratna's window room. Normally he might have heard the hanging girl, at least the falling plaster and the presumed grinding of the ceiling light fixture. But the musician went away every Christmas. Harry usually went away for Christmas, too. On his way to the police station to report the suicide, for he already knew it was not a murder, he'd looked back at the Oude Kennisteeg only once. In the new fallen snow, the tire marks from his bicycle were the sole evidence of life on the tiny street. Opposite the old church, there was only one woman working as a window prostitute that Christmas morning. She was one of the fat black women from Ghana. And Harry paused to give her all his presents. She was happy to have the chocolates and the fruitcake, but she told him she had no use for the Christmas tree ornaments. As for the cross of Lorraine, Harry had kept it for a while. He even bought a chain for it, although the chain cost him more than the cross. Then he'd given the cross and the chain to a girlfriend of the moment, but he made the mistake of telling the girlfriend the whole story. It was one of those things he was always misjudging about women. He thought she would take the cross and the story as a compliment. After all, he'd been genuinely fond of the Russian girl. This particular cross of Lorraine had some sentimental value for him, but no woman likes to hear how cheap a piece of jewelry was, or that it was purchased for another woman, not to mention for an illegal alien, a Russian whore who'd hanged herself in her place of business. The girlfriend of that moment had given Harry back his gift of some sentimental value. It was of no such value to her. Presently, Harry didn't have a girlfriend, nor did he imagine that he would ever be inclined to bestow his cross of Lorraine on another woman, even if there were another woman. Harry Hoekstra had never suffered from a shortage of girlfriends. The problem, if it was a problem, was that he always had this or that girl for only a moment. He was not a libertine. He never cheated on his girls. He had them only one at a time. But whether they left him or he left them, they didn't last. Now, stalling at the task of cleaning out his desk, Sergeant Hoekstra, at 57 and fully intending to retire later in the fall when he would be 58, wondered if he would always be unattached. Surely his attitude toward women, and theirs toward him, was at least partially job-related. And at least part of the reason why Harry had opted for an early retirement was that he wanted to see if his assumption was true. He'd been 18 when he'd first gone to work as a cop on the street. At 58, he would have put in 40 years of service. Naturally, Sergeant Hoekstra would be given a slightly smaller pension than if he waited until the standard retirement age of 61. But as an unmarried man with no children, he wasn't in need of a bigger pension. And the men in Harry's family had all died fairly young. While Harry was in excellent health, he was taking no chances on his genetic predisposition. He wanted to travel. He also wanted to try living in the country. Although he'd read a lot of travel books, he'd taken few trips, and although Harry liked travel books, he liked novels still more. Looking at his desk, which he was loath to open, Sergeant Hoekstra thought, "It's about time for a new novel by Ruth Cole, isn't it? It must have been 5 years since he'd read Not for Children. How long did it take her to write a novel, anyway?" Harry had read all of Ruth's novels in English, for Harry's English was quite good. And in the streets of the Red Light District, in The Little Walls, English was increasingly becoming the language of the prostitutes and their customers. Bad English was the new language of Dvalin. Bad English, Harry thought, would be the language of the next world. And as a man whose next life was about to begin at 58, Sergeant Hoekstra, a soon-to-be-retired civil servant, wanted his English to be good. The Reader. Sergeant Hoekstra's women usually complained about his indifference to shaving. That he was clearly not vain may have attracted the women in the first place, but eventually they took his lack of attention to his face as a sign that he was indifferent to them. When the stubble on his face began to resemble a beard, he shaved. Harry didn't like beards. Sometimes he would shave every other day, sometimes only once a week. Other times he would get up in the night and shave so that the woman he was with would wake up to a different-looking man in the morning. Harry exhibited a similar indifference toward his clothes. Harry's job was walking. He wore sturdy, comfortable running shoes. Jeans were the only pants of necessity. He had short, bandy legs, a flat stomach, and the non-existent bum of a young boy. From the waist down, he was built a lot like Ted Cole, compact, all function. But his upper body was more developed. He went to a gym every day. He had the well-rounded chest of a weightlifter, but because he generally wore long-sleeved, loose-fitting shirts, the casual observer never knew how muscular he was. These shirts were the only colorful part of his wardrobe. Most of his women commented that they were too colorful, or at least too busy. He liked shirts with a lot going on, he used to say. They were the kind of shirts you could never wear with a tie, but Harry almost never wore a tie anyway. He rarely wore his police uniform either. He was as familiar to everyone in Dvalin as the most flamboyant and long in residence of the window prostitutes. He walked the district for at least 2 or 3 hours every working day or night. For a jacket, he preferred windbreakers or something water-repellent, always in dark, solid colors.
He had an old leather jacket that was lined with wool flannel for the cold weather, but all his jackets, like his shirts, were loose-fitting. He didn't want his Walther 9mm, which he carried in a shoulder holster, to make a visible lump. Only if it was raining hard would he wear a baseball cap. He didn't like hats, and he never wore gloves. One of Harry's ex-girlfriends had described his mode of dress as basic thug. As for his hair, which was dark brown but turning grey, Harry was as indifferent to it as he was to shaving. He had it cut too short, then he let it grow too long. As for his police uniform, Harry had worn it much more frequently in his first 4 years, when he'd served in the west of Amsterdam. He still had his apartment there, not because he was too lazy to move, but because he liked the luxury of having two functioning fireplaces, one in his bedroom. His chief indulgences were firewood and books. Harry loved reading by a fire, and he owned so many books that it would have been a chore for him to move anywhere. Besides, he liked bicycling to work and home again. He believed in putting some distance between himself and Devalon. As familiar as he was with the red light district, and as recognizable a figure as he was in its crowded streets, for Devalon was his real office, the little walls were the well-known drawers of his real desk, Harry Hoekstra was a loner. What Harry's women also complained about was how much he remained apart. He would rather read a book than listen. And regarding talk, Harry would rather build a fire and go to bed and watch the firelight flickering on the walls and on the ceiling. He also liked to read in bed. Harry wondered if only his women were jealous of books. It was their principal preposterousness, he believed. How could they be jealous of books? He found this all the more preposterous in the cases of those women he'd met in bookstores. Harry had met a lot of women in bookstores. Others, although fewer lately, he'd met in his gym. Harry's gym was the one on the Rokin where Ruth Cole's publisher, Martin Schouten, had taken her. At 57, Sergeant Hoekstra was a little old for most of the women who went there, young women in their 20s telling him that he was in terrific shape for a guy his age, would never become the high point of his day. But he'd recently dated one of the women who worked at the gym, an aerobics instructor. Harry hated aerobics. He was strictly a weightlifter. In a day, Sergeant Hoekstra walked more than most people walked in a week or in a month. And he rode his bicycle everywhere. What did he need aerobics for? The instructor had been an attractive woman in her late 30s, but she was given to missionary zeal. Her failure to convert Harry to her exercise of choice had hurt her feelings, and no one in Harry's recent memory had so resented his reading. The aerobics instructor had not been a reader, and, like all of Harry's women, she'd refused to believe that Harry had never had sex with a prostitute. Surely he'd at least been tempted. He was tempted all the time, although with each passing year, the temptation grew less. In his almost 40 years as a cop, he'd been tempted to kill a couple of people, too. But Sergeant Hoekstra hadn't killed anybody. And he hadn't had sex with a prostitute. Yet there was no question that Harry's girlfriends were uniformly uneasy about his relationships with those women in the windows, and in ever-increasing numbers on the streets. He was a man of the streets, Harry was, which may have immeasurably contributed to his fondness for books and fireplaces. That he'd been a man of the streets for almost 40 years definitely contributed to his desire to try living in the country. Harry Hoekstra had had it with cities, with any city. Only one of his girlfriends had liked to read as much as Harry did, but she read the wrong books. Among the women Harry had slept with, she was also the closest to being a prostitute. She was a lawyer who did volunteer work for a prostitutes organization, a liberal feminist who told Harry that she identified with prostitutes. The organization for prostitutes' rights was called De Rode Draad, the Red Thread. At the time Harry met the lawyer, the Red Thread enjoyed an uneasy alliance with the police.
After all, both the police and the Red Thread were concerned for the prostitute's safety. Harry always thought that it should have been a more successful alliance than it was. But from the beginning, the board members at the Red Thread had rubbed him the wrong way. In addition to the more militant prostitutes and ex-prostitutes, there were those women, like his lawyer friend, who'd struck him as impractical feminists, concerned mainly with making the organization an emancipation movement for prostitutes. Harry had believed from the beginning that the Red Thread should be less concerned with manifestos and more concerned with protecting the prostitutes from the dangers of their profession. Yet he'd preferred the prostitutes and the feminists to the other members of the board, the labor union types, and what Harry called the how-to-get-subsidized people. The lawyer's name was Natasha Fredericks. Two-thirds of the women who worked for the Red Thread were prostitutes or ex-prostitutes. At their meetings, the non-prostitutes, like Natasha, were not allowed to speak. The Red Thread paid only 2.5 salaries to 4 people. Everyone else involved there was a volunteer. Harry had been a volunteer, too. In the late 80s, there'd been more interaction between the police and the Red Thread than there was now. For one thing, the organization had failed to attract the foreign prostitutes, not to mention the illegals, and there were hardly any Dutch prostitutes left in the windows or on the streets. Harry's lawyer friend, Natasha Fredericks, wasn't doing volunteer work for the Red Thread anymore. She'd become disillusioned, too. Natasha now called herself an ex-idealist. She and Harry had first met at a regular Thursday afternoon meeting for first-time prostitutes. Harry thought these meetings were a good idea. He sat in the back of the room and never spoke unless asked a direct question. He was introduced to the first-time prostitutes as one of the more sympathetic members of the police force, and the new girls were encouraged to talk with him after the usual business of the meeting was over. As for the usual business, there was often an older prostitute who told the first-timers what to be careful of. One of the old-timers was Dolores de Ruyter, or Red Dolores, as Harry and everyone in the Red Light District knew her. Roya Dolores had been a hooker in De Vallen and later on the Bergstraat a lot longer than Natasha Fredericks had been a lawyer. What Roya always told the new girls was to make sure the customer had a hard-on. She wasn't kidding. If the guy's in the room with you, I mean the second he puts his foot in the door, he should have an erection. If he didn't, Roya warned the new girls, maybe he hadn't come for sex. And never shut your eyes, Roya always admonished the new girls. Some guys like you to shut your eyes, just don't. There'd been nothing unpleasant or even disappointing in his sexual relationship with Natasha Fredericks, but what Harry most vividly remembered was how they had argued about books. Natasha had been born to argue, and Harry didn't like to argue, but he enjoyed having a girlfriend who read as much as he did, even if she read the wrong books. Natasha read non-fiction of the change-the-world variety. She read tracts. They were mostly books of leftist-leaning, wishful thinking. Harry didn't believe that the world or human nature could be changed. Harry's job was to understand and accept the existing world. Maybe he made the world a little safer, he liked to think. He read novels because he found in them the best descriptions of human nature. The novelists Harry liked never suggested that even the worst human behavior was alterable. They might morally disapprove of this or that character. But novelists were not world changers. They were just storytellers with better-than-average stories to tell. And the good ones told stories about believable characters. The novels Harry loved were complexly interwoven stories about real people. He didn't enjoy detective novels or so-called thrillers. Either he figured out the plot too soon, or the characters were implausible. He would never have marched into a bookstore demanding to be shown the classics or the newest literary fiction, but he ended up reading more classics and more literary novels than any other kind, although they were all novels of a fairly conventional narrative structure. Harry didn't object to a book being funny, but if the writer was only comic or merely satirical, Harry felt let down. He liked social realism, but not if the writer was without any imagination, not if the story wasn't enough of a story to keep him guessing about what was going to happen next. A novel about a divorced woman who spends a weekend at a resort hotel where she sees a man she imagines having an affair with, but she doesn't, she just goes home again, was not enough of a novel to satisfy Sergeant Hoekstra. Natasha Fredericks said that Harry's taste in novels was escapist, but Harry adamantly believed it was Natasha who was escaping the world with her idiotic non-fiction of idle wishfulness about how to change it. Among contemporary novelists, Sergeant Hoekstra's favorite was Ruth Cole. Natasha and Harry had argued about Ruth Cole more than about any other author. The lawyer who'd volunteered her services to the Red Thread because she said she identified with prostitutes asserted that Ruth Cole's stories were too bizarre. The lawyer who was a champion of rights for prostitutes, but who was not allowed to speak at any of the organization's meetings, claimed that the plots of Ruth Cole's novels were too unlikely. What's more, Natasha didn't like plot. The real world, which she so fervently sought to change, was without a discernible plot of its own, Natasha said. Natasha, who, like Harry, would one day quit volunteering for the Red Thread because the prostitutes' organization represented fewer than a 20th of the active prostitutes in the city of Amsterdam, accused Ruth Cole of being too unrealistic for her tastes. At the time, both Harry and Natasha would quit their volunteer work for the Red Thread. The Thursday afternoon meetings for first-time prostitutes drew less than 5% of the first-time prostitutes working in Dvalin. "Ruth Cole is more realistic than you are," Harry had told Natasha. They'd broken up because Natasha said Harry lacked ambition. He didn't even want to be a detective. He was content to be just a cop on the beat. It was true that Harry needed to be on the streets. If he wasn't out there walking in his real office, he didn't feel like a policeman at all. On the same floor where Harry's official office was, the detectives had their own office. It was full of computers at which they spent too much time. Harry's best friend among the detectives was Nico Janssen. Nico liked to tease Harry that the last murder of a prostitute in Amsterdam, which was the murder of Dolores de Ruyter in her window room on the Bergstraat, had been solved by his computer in the detective's computer room. But Harry knew better. Harry knew it was the mystery witness who'd really solved the prostitute's murder. It had been Harry's analysis of the eyewitness account, which, after all, had been addressed to him, that had eventually told Nico Janssen what to look for in his overpraised computer. But theirs was a friendly argument. The case was solved. That was the main thing, Nico said. However, it was the witness who still interested Harry. And he didn't like it that his witness had slipped away. It was all the more maddening to him because he was absolutely certain that he'd seen her. He'd actually seen her. And she'd still got away. The middle drawer of Sergeant Hoekstra's desk heartened him. There was nothing in it that he needed to throw away. There were a dozen old pens and a few keys that Harry didn't recognize, but his replacement might derive some satisfying curiosity from speculating what the keys were for. There was also a combination bottle opener and corkscrew. Even in a police station, one could never have enough of those. And there was a teaspoon, not too clean, but one could always clean it. You never knew when you might get sick and need a teaspoon to take your medicine, Harry thought. He was about to close the drawer, leaving the contents undisturbed, when an item of even more remarkable usefulness caught his eye. It was the broken handle to the desk's bottommost drawer, and no one but Harry knew what a truly useful little tool it was. It fit perfectly between the treads of Harry's running shoes. He used it to scrape the dog shit off his soles, if and when he stepped in any. However, Harry's replacement would not necessarily realize the broken handle's value. Using one of the pens, Harry wrote a note, which he put in the middle drawer before closing it. "Don't fix bottommost drawer, but save broken handle. Excellent for getting dog shit off shoes. Harry Hoekstra." Thus encouraged, Harry took the three side drawers of the desk in order, starting at the top. In the first of them was a speech he'd written but had never delivered to the members of the Red Thread organization. It concerned the matter of underage prostitutes. Harry had reluctantly assented to the position taken by the prostitutes organization that the legal age for prostitutes be lowered from 18 to 16. "No one likes the idea of minors working in prostitution," Harry's speech had begun. "But I like less the idea of minors working in dangerous places. Minors are going to be prostitutes anyway. Many brothel owners won't care if their prostitutes are only 16-year-olds. What's important is that the 16-year-olds can make use of the same social services and health care facilities that the older prostitutes use, without being afraid that they will be turned over to the police." It was not cowardice that had prevented Harry from giving his speech. Harry had contradicted the official police position before. It was that he hated the whole idea of allowing 16-year-olds to be prostitutes only because you couldn't stop them from being prostitutes. On the issue of accepting the real world and making an educated guess about how to make it marginally safer, even a social realist like Harry Hoekstra would have admitted that certain subjects depressed him. He had not given the speech because, in the long run, it would be of no practical help to the underage prostitutes. Just as the Thursday afternoon meetings for first-time prostitutes were of no practical help to the vast majority of them. They didn't or wouldn't attend the meetings. In all likelihood, they didn't know that the meetings existed. Or if they had known, they wouldn't have cared. But perhaps the speech would be of some practical use to the next cop who sat at his desk, Harry thought. And so he left the speech where it was. In regard to the middle of the three side drawers, Harry was at first alarmed to see that it was empty. He stared into the drawer with the dismay of a man who'd been robbed in a police station. Then he recalled that the drawer had been empty for as long as he could remember. The desk itself was a testimony to how little Sergeant Hoekstra had used it. In truth, the alleged task of cleaning it out was entirely focused on the unfinished business that, for 5 years now, Harry had faithfully kept in the bottommost drawer. In his view, it was the only police business that stood between him and his retirement. Since the handle to the bottommost drawer had broken off and become Harry's tool of choice for removing dog shit from his shoes, he presently had to pry the drawer open with his pocket knife. The file on the witness to the murder of Roya Dolores was disappointingly thin, which belied how often and how closely Sergeant Hoekstra had read and reread it. Harry appreciated a complicated plot, but he had a stodgy preference for chronological stories. It was ass-backward storytelling to find the murderer before you found the witness. In a proper story, you found the witness first. Ruth Cole had more than a policeman searching for her. She had an old-fashioned reader on her case. The Prostitute's Daughter. Roya had started as a window prostitute in Devon during Harry's first year as a street cop in the Red Light District. She was 5 years younger than he was, although he'd suspected her of lying about her age. In her first window room on the Oude Kennisteeg, the same small street where Vratna would later hang herself, Dolores de Ruyter had looked younger than 18. But that was how old she was. She'd been telling the truth. Harry Hoekstra had been 23. In Harry's opinion, Red Dolores had generally not told the truth, or she told mostly half-truths. On her busiest days, Roya had worked in her window room for 10 or 12 hours straight, during which time she'd accommodated as many as 15 clients. She made enough money to buy a ground-floor room on the Bergstraat, which she rented part-time to another prostitute. By then, she'd lightened her workload to only 3 days a week, 5 hours a day, and she could still afford 2 vacations a year. She always spent Christmas at some ski resort in the Alps, and every April she went somewhere warm. She'd once been in Rome for Easter. She'd been to Florence, too, and to Spain and Portugal and the south of France. Roya had a habit of asking Harry Hoekstra where she should go. After all, he'd read those countless travel books. Although Harry had never been to any of the places Roya wanted her to go, he'd researched all the hotels. Harry knew that Roya preferred to stay in moderately expensive surroundings. He also knew that while her warm weather holidays were important to her, Roya took greater pleasure from the ski resorts at Christmas time. And even though she would take a few private ski lessons every winter, she never got beyond the beginner level. When she'd finished with the lessons, she would ski only half days by herself, and only until she met someone. Roya always met someone. She'd told Harry it was fun to meet someone who didn't know she was a prostitute. Occasionally, they were well-off young men who skied hard and partied harder. More often, they were quiet, even somber men who were no better than intermediate skiers. Her particular fondness was for divorced fathers who got to spend only every other Christmas with their children. Generally speaking, the fathers with sons were easier to seduce than the fathers with daughters. It always gave Roya a pang to see a man and a child in a restaurant together. They were often not talking, or their conversation was awkward, usually about the skiing or the food. She could detect in the father's faces a kind of loneliness that was different from but similar to the loneliness in the faces of her colleagues on the Bergstraat. And a romance with a father who was traveling with his child was always delicate and secretive. For someone who didn't have many real romances in her life, Roya believed that delicacy and secrecy were enhancing to sexual tension. Also, there was nothing quite like the carefulness required when one had to take into consideration the feelings of a child. "Aren't you afraid that these guys will want to come see you in Amsterdam?" Harry had asked. She'd been to Zermatt that year. But only once had someone insisted on coming to Amsterdam to see her. Usually she'd managed to discourage it. "What do you tell them you do?" Harry had asked her another time. Roya had just returned from Pontresina, where she'd met a man who was staying with his son at Badrut's palace in St. Moritz. Red Dolores always told the fathers a comfortable half-truth. "I make a modestly good living from prostitution," Roya would begin, watching the shock settle in. "Oh, I don't mean I'm a prostitute," she then would say. "I'm just an impractical landlady who rents to prostitutes." If pressed, she would elaborate the lie. Her father, a urologist, had died. She'd converted his office to a prostitute's window room. Renting to prostitutes, though less profitable, was more colorful than renting office space to doctors. She loved to tell Harry Hoekstra the stories she'd made up. If Harry had been at best a vicarious traveler, he had also vicariously enjoyed Roya's little romances. And he knew why there was a urologist in Roya's story. An actual urologist had been Roya's constant admirer, and her most regular client well into his 80s, before dropping dead in the prostitute's room on the Bergstraat one Sunday afternoon. He'd been such an unfailing sweetheart that he often forgot to have the sex he paid for. Roya had been very fond of the dear old man, Dr. Bosman, who swore to her that he loved his wife, his children, and his innumerable grandchildren, the family photos of whom he showed to Roya with unflagging pride. The day he died, he sat fully clothed in the blowjob chair, complaining that he'd eaten too much for lunch, even for a Sunday. he asked Roya to fix him a bicarbonate of soda, for which he confessed to having an even greater need at the moment than he had for what he called her inestimable physical affections. Roya was forever grateful that her back was turned to him when he expired in the chair. After she'd fixed the sodium bicarbonate, she turned to face him, but old Dr. Bosman was dead. Roya's penchant for half-truths had betrayed her then. She'd called Harry Hoekstra and told him that an old man was dead in her window room, but that at least she'd saved him from dying in the street. She'd seen him looking decidedly unwell, half staggering on the Bergstraat, and she'd brought him into her room and sat him down in a comfortable chair where he'd begged her for a bicarbonate of soda. "Tell my wife I love her," were the old man's last words, Roya had informed Harry. She'd not told Harry that the dead urologist had been her oldest and most regular client. She genuinely wanted to spare Dr. Bosman's family the knowledge that their beloved patriarch had died with his long-standing whore. But Harry had figured it out. There was something about how peaceful Dr. Bosman looked in Red Dolores's blowjob chair. That, and how noticeably upset Roya had been. In her own way, she'd loved the old urologist. "How long had he been seeing you?" Harry immediately asked her. Roya burst into tears. "He was always so nice to me," Roya had cried. "No one was ever as nice to me, not even you, Harry." Harry had helped Roya work on her story. It was basically the lie she'd first told him, but Harry helped her get the details right. Exactly where on the Bergstraat had Roya first noticed that the old doctor was half staggering, as she'd put it? Exactly how had she got him to come inside her room? And didn't she have to help him to the chair? And when the dying urologist had asked the prostitute to tell his wife that he loved her, had his voice been strained? Was his breathing restricted? Had he been in any obvious pain? Surely Dr. Bosman's wife would want to know. The widow Bosman had been so grateful to Roya Dolores that the merciful prostitute had been invited to the old urologist's memorial service. Everyone in Dr. Bosman's family had spoken to Roya of their deep gratitude to her. Over time, the Bosmans had made the prostitute a virtual member of their family. They developed the habit of inviting Roya to their Christmas and Easter dinners, and to other family gatherings, weddings, anniversaries. Harry Hoekstra had often reflected that Roya's half-truth about Dr. Bosman was probably the best lie he'd ever been associated with. "How was your trip?" Harry would always ask the prostitute, whenever she'd been away. But the rest of the time he asked her, "How are the Bosmans?" And when Dolores de Rauter had been murdered in her window room, Harry had notified the Bosmans straight away. There was no one else he needed to inform. Harry also trusted that the Bosmans would bury her. In fact, Mrs. Bosman organized and paid for the prostitute's funeral. Quite a sizable representation of the Bosman family was in attendance, together with a scattering of policemen, Harry among them, and a similarly small number of women from the Red Thread. Harry's ex-girlfriend, Natasha Fredericks, was there, but by far the most impressive turnout came from Roya's other family, namely the prostitutes, who turned out in droves. Roya had been popular among her colleagues. Dolores de Rauter had lived a life of half-truths. And what was not the best of her lies, indeed what Harry thought of as one of the most painful lies he'd ever been associated with, became evident at the funeral. One after another, the prostitutes who'd known Roya took Harry aside to ask him the same question. "Where's the daughter?" Or looking over the multitude of old Dr. Bosman's grandchildren, they would ask, "Which one is she? Isn't the daughter here?" "Roya's daughter is dead," Harry had to tell them. "In fact, she's been dead for quite a number of years." In truth, only Harry knew. The prostitute's daughter had died before she was born. But that had been Roya's well-kept secret. Harry had first heard of Roya's Englishman after the prostitute returned from a ski holiday in Klosters. On Harry's advice, she'd stayed at the Chesa Grishuna, where she'd met an Englishman named Richard Smalley. Smalley was divorced and spending Christmas with his 6-year-old son, a neurasthenic wreck of a boy whose perpetual nervousness and exhaustion Smalley blamed on the boy's overprotective mother. Roya had been more than usually touched by the two of them. The boy clung to his father, and he slept so fitfully that it had been impossible for Richard Smalley and Roya to have sex. They'd managed some stolen kisses, as Roya had told Harry, and some pretty intense fondling. She'd had all she could do to keep Smalley from coming to Amsterdam to see her in the ensuing year. The next Christmas, it was the ex-wife's turn with the neurasthenic son. Richard Smalley returned to Klosters alone. Over the course of the year, in letters and in phone calls, he'd persuaded Roya to join him for Christmas at the Chase, a dangerous precedent, Harry had warned Roya. It was the first time she'd spent a second Christmas at the same ski resort. She and Smalley had fallen in love. The prostitute informed Harry upon her return to Amsterdam. Richard Smalley wanted to marry her. He wanted Roya to have his child. "But does the Englishman know you're a prostitute?" Harry had asked. It turned out that Roya had told Richard Smalley she was an ex-prostitute. She'd come halfway to the truth, which she hoped would be far enough. That winter she rented her window room on the Bergstraat to two more girls. With three girls paying her rent for the room, Roya could almost match what she'd earned as a prostitute. It would at least be enough for her to live on until she married Smalley, and more than enough supplementary income after she was married. But when she moved in with Smalley in London, Roya became an absentee landlady to three window prostitutes in Amsterdam. While Roya had been careful not to rent to drug addicts, she couldn't oversee how the girls were treating her old place on the Bergstraat. Harry had tried to keep an eye on the room, but Roya's tenants took liberties. Soon, one of the girls was subletting to a fourth prostitute, and quickly there was a fifth. One of them was a drug addict. Then one of Roya's original tenants left. She'd skipped 2 months' rent before Roya even knew she was gone. Roya was pregnant when she returned to Amsterdam to assess the condition of her room on the Bergstraat. Some instinct made her hang on to the place, which was barely breaking even, and after a few necessary repairs and some serious cleaning bills, the room was probably costing her money. The Englishman wanted her to sell it. But Roya found two ex-prostitutes, both of them Dutch, who wanted her to get back into the business. By renting exclusively to them, Roya thought she could meet the maintenance costs. "The hell with trying to make a profit," she'd told Harry. "I just want to keep the place in case things don't work out in England." She must have known then, when she was 7 months pregnant, that things weren't going to work out with Richard Smalley. She'd eventually gone into labor in London, and it had been a bad birth from the beginning. Despite an emergency C-section, the fetus was still born. Roya never saw her dead daughter. It was then that Smalley had started in with the predictable recriminations. There was something wrong with Roya, which had caused the stillbirth, and what was wrong with her had something to do with her past life as a prostitute. She must have done too much fucking. One day, unannounced, Roya was back in her window on the Bergstraat. That was when Harry learned about the end of Roya's marriage and her stillborn daughter. By then, of course, Roya's English was pretty good. The next Christmas, she'd gone again to Klosters and stayed once more at the Chesa Grishuna, but that would be her last holiday in a ski town. Although neither Richard Smalley nor his neurasthenic son was there, some word of who Roya was must have got around. In unpredictable situations, which she couldn't foresee, she was aware that she was being treated as an ex-prostitute, not as an ex-wife. She swore to Harry that she'd overheard someone on a gondola whispering the words, "Smalley's whore." And in the Chesa, where she ate every evening alone, a small, bald man in a velvet dinner jacket with a flaming orange ascot had propositioned her. A waiter had brought Roya a complimentary glass of champagne from the bald man, together with a note in hand-printed English capitals. "How much?" the note had asked. She'd sent back the champagne. Shortly after this final visit to Klosters, Roya had stopped working in her window on weekends. Later still, she stopped working nights, and soon she was leaving her window in mid-afternoon, in time to pick her daughter up from school. That was what she told everyone. The other prostitutes on the Bergstraat would occasionally ask to see pictures. Naturally, they understood why they'd never seen the alleged daughter in the vicinity of the Bergstraat. Most prostitutes kept their work a secret from their younger children. The prostitute with whom Roya shared her window room was the most curious, and Roya had a photograph that she liked to show. The little girl in the photo was about 5 or 6. She was happily seated on Roya's lap at what looked like a family dinner party. She was one of Dr. Bosman's grandchildren, of course. Only Harry Hoekstra knew that the photograph had been taken at one of the Bosman's Easter dinners. So that was the prostitute's daughter, whose absence had never been as noticeable as it was at Roya's funeral. At that confused gathering, some of the prostitutes had asked Harry to remind them of the missing daughter's name. It wasn't a common name. Did Harry remember what it was? Of course he did. It was Chesa. And following Roya's funeral, at what amounted to the wake, for old Mrs. Bosman, who was paying, believed in wakes, the name of the dead daughter had been sufficiently repeated among the prostitutes so that the old widow herself approached Harry. He was awkwardly attempting to dispose of a hard-boiled egg that he didn't want to eat. The egg had some kind of caviar on it. "Who's Chesa?" old Mrs. Bosman asked. Harry then told her the whole story. The story moved Mrs. Bosman to tears, but the old lady was no fool. "Of course I knew that my dear husband was visiting the prostitute," she confided to Harry. "But the way I see it, she did me a kindness, and she did keep him from dying in the street." Only a few years before her murder, Roya Dolores had reduced her annual vacations to one warm-weather holiday in April. She'd spent her last Christmases with the Bosmans. There were so many grandchildren that Roya had a lot of presents to buy. "It's still cheaper than going skiing," she told Harry. And one April, it was the spring before she was killed, Roya had asked Harry to join her on her warm-weather holiday on a 50-50 basis. "You're the one with the travel books," she'd teased him. "You pick the place and I'll go with you." Whatever had been the charm of those divorced fathers, taking perpetual vacations with their subdued children, the charm had finally worn thin with her. Harry had imagined taking a trip with Roya for a long time, yet her invitation both surprised and embarrassed him. The first place he'd thought of being with her was Paris. Imagine being in Paris with a prostitute. Harry had started writing in the margins of his travel books and underlining key sentences about the appropriate hotels. One of the first hotels Harry considered staying in was the Hotel de Quai Voltaire, the same hotel where Ted had taken the photograph of Marion with Thomas and Timothy's feet. But the Hotel du Quai Voltaire was not as highly recommended as the Hotel de l'Abbaye or the Duc de Saint-Simon. Harry had decided that he wanted to stay somewhere in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, but he believed that the choice of their hotel should be left to Roya. Harry brought his Paris guidebooks, replete with his underlinings and marginalia, to Roya's room on the Bergstraat. He'd had to linger in the street until she finished with a customer. "Oh, Harry," she'd cried, "you want to take an old whore to Paris?" Neither of them had ever been to Paris. It would never have worked out. Harry could imagine Roya liking Notre Dame and the Tuileries and the antique shops that he'd only read about. He could see her happily on his arm in the gardens of the Luxembourg, but he couldn't quite picture her at the Louvre. After all, she lived in Amsterdam, and she'd not once been to the Rijksmuseum. How could Harry have taken her to Paris? "Actually, I don't think I can get away," he hedged. "April gets busy in Ivalen." "Then we'll go in March,"
Roya told him. "We'll go in May. What's it matter?"
"I don't think I can really do it, Roya," Harry had admitted to her.
"Prostitutes are familiar enough with rejection. They handle it pretty well." When he got the call that Roya had been murdered, Harry had looked around her room on the Bergstraat for the guidebooks, which Roya hadn't returned. They were stacked on the narrow reading table in the WC, which is exactly where he left them. He also noted that the murderer had bitten Roya, and that the way her body had been carelessly pushed off the bed made it seem there had been nothing ritualistic about the killing. She'd most likely been strangled, but there were no thumbprint or fingerprint bruises at her throat. This pointed to her being choked with a forearm, the Hofdagent had thought. That was when he saw the wardrobe closet with the shoes' pointed toes out. A pair of them had been kicked out of alignment with the others, and there was a space in the middle of the row where another pair of shoes would have fitted. Shit! There was a witness. Harry had known then. He knew that Roya had been one of the few prostitutes who went out of her way to do a kindness for the first-timers. He also knew the way she did it. She let the first-timers watch her with the customer just to see how it was done. She'd hidden a lot of girls in her wardrobe closet. Harry had heard about Roya's method at one of the meetings for first-time prostitutes at the Red Thread. But Roya hadn't gone to those meetings for quite some time. Harry wasn't even sure if the Red Thread still held meetings for first-time prostitutes. In the open doorway to Roya's window room, the sniveling girl who'd found Roya's body sat sobbing. Her name was Annika Smets. She was a recovered heroin addict. At least, she'd convinced Roya that she was recovered. Annika Smets was not dressed, or undressed, for working in the window. Usually she wore a leather halter top, which Harry had seen hanging in the closet. But in the doorway, Annika looked plain and disheveled. She wore a baggy black sweater with stretched-out elbows and jeans that were ripped in both knees. She had no makeup on, not even lipstick, and her hair was dirty and stiff. The only suggested wildness amid everything that was plain about her was that Annika Smets had a tattoo of a lightning bolt, albeit a small one, on the inside of her right wrist. "It appears that someone might have been watching from the wardrobe closet," Harry had begun. Still sobbing, the girl had nodded her head. "It looks like it," she'd agreed. "Was she helping out her first-timer?" Harry asked Annika. "Nobody I knew," said the sobbing girl. And so Harry Hoekstra suspected, even before Ruth Cole's eyewitness account arrived at the Walmustraat station, that there'd been a witness. "Oh, God," Annika had suddenly cried. "Nobody picked her daughter up from school. Who's going to tell her daughter?" "Somebody already picked her up," Harry had lied. "Somebody already told the daughter." But he told the truth a few days later, when his best friend among the detectives, Nico Janssen, had wanted a word with Harry in private. Harry knew what the word would be about. There were the Paris guidebooks on Janssen's desk. Harry Hoekstra wrote his name in all his books. Nico Janssen opened one of the travel books to the part about the Hôtel Duc de Saint-Simon. Harry had written in the margin, "The heart of the Faubourg Saint-Germain, a great location."
"Isn't that your handwriting, Harry?" Janssen asked him.
"My name's in the front of the book, Nico."
"Did you miss my name?" Harry asked his friend.
"Were you planning a trip with her?"
Detective Janssen asked.
Harry had been a cop for more than 3 decades. At last, he knew how it felt to be a suspect. Harry had explained that Roya took a lot of trips. All Harry did was read the travel books. He'd long been in the habit of lending her his guidebooks, Harry said. She'd been accustomed to asking him where she should stay and what she should see.
"But you didn't have a relationship with Roya, did you, Harry?" Nico had asked. "You never actually took a trip with her, did you?"
"No, I never did," Harry had replied. It was generally a good idea to tell the cops the truth.
Harry hadn't had a relationship with Roya. He'd never taken a trip with her either. That much was true. But the cops didn't have to know everything. It wasn't necessary for Nico Jansen to know that Harry had been tempted. Oh, how he'd been tempted.
Sergeant Hoekstra finds his witness. Nowadays, Sergeant Hoekstra wore his police uniform only on those occasions when the red light district was overrun with tourists or out-of-towners. He'd worn it to Roya's funeral, too. And when it came to giving tours, Harry was the second district's cop of choice, not only because he spoke better English and German than any other policeman in the Vamustrat station, but also because he was the acknowledged expert on the red light district, and he loved to take people there. He'd once shown de Valen to a group of nuns. He not infrequently showed the little walls to schoolchildren. The window prostitutes would calmly look the other way when they saw the children coming, but once a woman in a window had abruptly closed her curtain. Later she told Harry that she'd recognized her own child among the group. Sergeant Hoekstra was also the second district's cop of choice when it came to talking to the media. Because false confessions were common, Harry had quickly learned never to give the exact details of a crime to the press. On the contrary, he often provided the journalists with false details. This tended to expose the crazies in a hurry. In the case of Red Dolores's murder, he'd managed to draw out a couple of false confessions by telling the journalists that Roya had been strangled after a violent struggle. The two false confessions were from men who said they'd choked Roya to death with their hands. One of them had persuaded his wife to scratch his face and the backs of his hands. The other had convinced his girlfriend to kick him repeatedly in the shins. In both cases, the men looked as if they'd been party to a violent struggle. As for the actual method of Roya's murder, the detectives had wasted no time at their computers. They'd conveyed the necessary information to Interpol in Wiesbaden, Germany, whereupon they discovered that there'd been a similar slaying of a prostitute in Zurich about 5 years earlier. All Roya had been able to do was to kick off one of her shoes. The prostitute in the area of the Langstrasse in Zurich had managed a little more resistance. She'd broken a fingernail in what must have been a brief struggle. Some fabric, presumably from the killer's suit pants, was caught under the prostitute's broken nail. It was a high-quality fabric, but so what? The most convincing connection between the Zurich murder and Roya's murder in Amsterdam was that, in Zurich, there'd also been a standing lamp with the lampshade and the light bulb removed but undamaged. The Zurich police hadn't known the part about photographing the victim. The murder in Zurich hadn't had a witness, nor had anyone mailed the Zurich police a tube of Polaroid print coater with a perfect print of the presumed killer's right thumb. None of the prints taken from the prostitute's room off the Langstrasse in Zurich had matched the Amsterdam thumbprint, however, and in Wiesbaden there was no matching thumbprint in the Interpol file either. The second print on the tube was a clear, small print of a right index finger. It indicated that the probable witness had picked up the print coater with her thumb and index finger at either end. The witness must have been a woman, everyone had decided, because the fingerprint was so much smaller than the print of the probable murderer's thumb. Another small but clear print of the witness's right index finger had been taken from one of the shoes pointed toes out in Roya's wardrobe closet. And the same right index finger had touched the inside doorknob of Roya's window room, doubtless when the witness had let herself out on the street, after the murderer had gone. Whoever she was right-handed, and she had a glass-thin, perfectly centered scar on her right index finger. But Interpol had no match for the probable witness's right index finger either. Not that Harry had expected Interpol to match that print. He was sure that his witness wasn't a criminal. and after a week of talking to the area's prostitutes, Harry was also sure that his witness wasn't a prostitute. She was probably a goddamn sex tourist. In a short period of time, less than a week, every prostitute on the Bergstraat had seen the likely witness as many as a half dozen times, and Annika Smeets had talked to her. The mystery woman had asked for Roya one night, and Annika, in her leather halter top and brandishing a dildo, had told the tourist Roya's alleged reason for not working at night. Roya was with her daughter, Annika had said. The prostitutes on the Korsche Spoorsteeg had seen the mystery woman, too. One of the younger whores told Harry that his witness was a lesbian, but the other prostitutes had strongly disagreed. They'd been wary of the woman because they couldn't tell what she wanted. As for the men who walked and walked past the window prostitutes, always looking, always horny, but never making a decision, they were called Hingston, stallions. And the prostitutes who'd seen Ruth Cole walking past their windows called her a female Hengst. But of course there is no such thing as a female stallion, which is why the mystery woman made the prostitutes uneasy. One of them said to Harry, "She looked like a reporter." Reporters made the prostitutes very uneasy. A foreign journalist? Sergeant Hoekstra had rejected the possibility. Most of the foreign journalists who came to Amsterdam with a professional interest in prostitution were told to talk to him. From the prostitutes in De Valen, Harry discovered that the mystery woman hadn't always been alone. There'd been a younger man with her, maybe a university student. While the witness Harry was looking for was in her 30s and had spoken only English, the boy had definitely been Dutch. That had answered one question for Sergeant Hoekstra. If his missing witness was an English-speaking foreigner, who had written the eyewitness account in Dutch? And some additional information shed a little light on the carefully printed document that the witness had mailed to Harry. A tattooist whom Harry regarded as a handwriting expert had looked at the meticulous lettering and concluded that the text had been copied. The tattooist's name was Henk, and he did most of the lettering at the tattooing museum in the Red Light District, the so-called House of Pain. His specialty was a poem, any poem you wanted, tattooed in the shape of a woman's body. According to him, the witness's pen had paused too long on every letter. Only someone copying a foreign language would have written each letter so slowly. "Who has to work this hard not to make a spelling mistake?" Henk had asked Harry. "Someone who doesn't know the language, that's who." The prostitutes in De Valen did not think Harry's witness and the Dutch boy had been a sexual couple. "It was not just the age difference," said the Thai prostitute whom Ruth and Wim had visited on the Bantesteeg. "I could tell they'd never had sex with each other." "Maybe they were working up to it," Harry had suggested. "Maybe they were going to have sex." "I didn't think so," the Thai prostitute said. "They couldn't even tell me what they wanted. They just wanted to watch. But they didn't even know what they wanted to watch." The other Thai prostitute, who remembered the unusual couple, was the old sadist with a reputation for terrorizing her clients. "The Dutch boy had a big one," she declared. "He really wanted to do it, but his mommy wouldn't let him." "That boy was ready to fuck anything except me," the transvestite from Ecuador told Harry. "The woman was merely curious. She wasn't going to have sex. She just wanted to know about it." If the Dutch boy had been with the mystery woman in Roya's closet, Harry was sure the two of them would have tried to stop the killing. And from the beginning, Harry had doubted that the witness was a first-time prostitute. Unless she'd been an illegal, even a first-timer would have gone to the police. And if she'd been an illegal, who would she have found to write her eyewitness account in such perfect Dutch? A Jamaican prostitute on the Slapersteeg also remembered Ruth Cole. "She was small. She said she was lost," the Jamaican told Harry. "I took her out of the alley by her arm. I was surprised she had such a strong right arm." That was when Sergeant Hoekstra realized
that he had seen the mystery woman himself. He suddenly recalled the woman he'd followed through Dvalin one early morning. She'd had an athletic way of walking. She was small, but she looked strong. She certainly hadn't looked lost. She'd looked purposeful, and Harry had followed her not only because she seemed out of place, he'd also followed her because she was strikingly attractive. When he became aware that she'd noticed him following her, Harry had gone back to the Varmustrat station. He'd spoken to the two fat prostitutes from Ghana last. The unknown tourist had paused on the Stofsteg long enough to ask the prostitutes where they were from. In turn, they'd asked Ruth Cole where she was from, and she'd told them she was from the United States. What Harry had learned from the prostitutes from Ghana, namely that his witness was an American, would turn out to be a more important bit of information than he'd first thought. Nico Janssen had come to a dead end on his computer. The Polaroid print coder with the azure blue cap could have been purchased in either Amsterdam or Zurich. That, according to the mystery witness, the murderer looked like a mole, that he wheezed, that he had squinty eyes, almost totally closed. Of what use was this without a fingerprint in Zurich that matched the thumbprint on the tube of Polaroid print coder in Amsterdam? And that the witness had thought the murderer worked for SAS, the Scandinavian airline, proved to be a false lead. Despite the examination of the prints of every male employee working in security for SAS, a matching thumbprint could not be found. It was only because Harry Hoekstra knew English so well, and German a little, that the murderer was ever caught. It turned out that the most important piece of information in the eyewitness's account was the observation that the murderer spoke English with what might have been a German-sounding accent. It was the day after Nico Janssen told Harry that the detectives had come to a dead end in regard to Roya's murder. Harry had gone back to the eyewitness account again. Suddenly he saw what he'd been missing. If the murderer's first language was German, SAS might not be SAS. In the German alphabet, as in the Dutch, A is pronounced as A. In the German alphabet, E is pronounced as A. And to an American witness, S-E-S would have sounded like S-A-S. The murderer had nothing to do with the Scandinavian airline. The murderer had something to do with security for a company called S-E-S. Harry didn't need Nico Janssen's computer to find out what S-E-S was. The International Chamber of Commerce was happy to help Harry find a company with those initials in a German-speaking city. And in less than 10 minutes, Harry had identified the murderer's employer, the venerable Schweizer Elektronik- und Sicherheitssysteme, SES, was located in Zurich. The company designed and installed security alarms for banks and museums all over Europe. It gave Harry some small pleasure to find Nico Janssen in the detective's room, where the computers always bathed the faces of the detectives in an unnatural light and bombarded them with unnatural sounds. "I've got something for you to feed to your computer, Nico," Harry had said. "If you want me to talk to your colleague in Zurich, my German's better than yours." The detective in Zurich was named Ernst Hecht. Like Harry, Ernst Hecht was getting ready to retire. He'd presumed he would never find out who killed a Brazilian prostitute in the area of the Langstrasse almost 6 years ago. But the Schweizer Elektronik- und Sicherheitssysteme was a small but important security alarm company. For insurance reasons, every employee of the company who'd ever designed or installed a security system for a bank or a museum had been fingerprinted. The thumb that matched the thumbprint on the Polaroid print coder belonged to a former employee, a security alarm engineer named Urs Messerli. Messerli had been in Amsterdam in the fall of 1990 to prepare an estimate for the expense of a fire and motion detection system in an art museum. He'd routinely traveled with an old Polaroid camera that used 4x5 land film, Type 55, whose black-and-white prints were preferred by all the engineers at SES. They were large-format prints with negatives.
Messerly had taken over 6 dozen photographs of the interior of the Art Museum in Amsterdam in order to know how many fire and motion detection devices would be needed and exactly where they should be installed. Urs Messerly was no longer working for SAS because he was very ill. He was hospitalized, presumed to be dying of a lung infection related to his emphysema, which he'd had for 15 years. Harry Hoekstra thought that someone suffering from emphysema probably sounded a lot like an asthmatic. The Universitätsspital in Zurich was famous for its care of emphysema patients. Ernst Hecht and Harry didn't have to worry about Urs Messerly slipping away before they could talk to him. Not unless Messerly slipped away into death. The patient was on oxygen most of the time. And Messerly suffered from another, more recent misfortune. His wife of some 30 years was divorcing him. While he lay dying, literally gasping for breath, Messerly's wife was also insisting that she not be written out of her husband's will. She'd discovered several photographs of naked women in his home office. Shortly after he'd been hospitalized, he'd asked her to look for some important papers, namely a codicil to his will. Frau Messerly had come upon the photographs quite innocently. By the time Harry flew to Zurich, Frau Messerly was still innocent of the most important content of those photographs of naked women, which she'd given to her divorce lawyer. Neither she nor her lawyer realized that they were photographs of prostitutes who were dead. That the women were naked was all that concerned them. Harry had no difficulty identifying Roya's photograph in Ernst Hecht's office. And Hecht had easily recognized the murdered Brazilian prostitute from the area of the Langstrasse. What a surprise both policemen was that there were a half dozen other photographs. The Schweizer Elektronik und Sicherheitssysteme Company had sent Urs Messerly all over Europe. He'd killed prostitutes in Frankfurt and in Brussels, in Hamburg and The Hague, in Vienna and Antwerp, too. He hadn't always killed them in the same efficient way, nor had he always lit his subjects with the same floodlight from his big leather briefcase. But he had always posed his dead girls in a similar fashion, lying on their sides, with their eyes closed, and with their knees drawn up to their chests in a modest, little girlish posture, which was why Messerly's wife and his wife's lawyer had never suspected that the naked women were dead. "You must congratulate your witness," Ernst Hecht had told Harry. They were en route to the Universitätsspital to see Urs Messerly before he died. Messerly had already confessed. "Oh, I will thank her," Harry had said, "when I find her." Urs Messerly's English was exactly as the mystery woman witness had described it. Messerly spoke English well, but with a German-sounding accent. Harry chose to speak to Messerly in English, especially since Ernst Hecht's English was pretty good, too. "In Amsterdam, on the Bergstraat," Harry had begun. "She had auburn hair and a good figure for a woman her age, but fairly small breasts."
"Yes, yes, I know,"
Urs Messerly had interrupted him. A nurse had to pull off the oxygen mask in order for Messerly to be able to speak. Then he would gasp. He made a sucking sound before the nurse covered his mouth and nose with a mask again. His grayness was far in advance of how gray he'd been when Ruth Cole had seen him and likened him to a mole. Now his skin resembled ash. The enlarged air spaces in his lungs made a sound of their own, which was separate from his ragged breathing. It was as if you could hear the damaged tissue that lined the walls of the air spaces breaking away. "You had a witness in Amsterdam," Harry told the murderer. "I don't suppose you got a look at her." For once the vestigial-like eyes opened wider, like a mole discovering sight. The nurse removed the oxygen mask again.
"Yes, yes, I heard her. Someone was there,"
Urs Messerly gasped.
"She made a small sound. I almost heard her."
A paroxysm of coughing overcame him. The nurse once more had to cover his mouth and nose with the mask. "She was in the wardrobe closet," Harry told Messerly.
All the shoes had been turned. They were pointed toes out. And she was standing among the shoes. You probably could have seen her ankles if you'd looked.
Urs Messerli was inexpressibly saddened by this news, as if he would have enjoyed at least meeting the witness, if not killing her. This happened in April of 91, 6 months after Roya's murder, 1 year after Harry Hoekstra had almost taken Dolores de Ruyter to Paris. That night in Zurich, Harry wished he had taken Roya to Paris. He didn't have to spend the night in Zurich. He could have flown back to Amsterdam at the end of that same day, but for once, he wanted to do something that he'd only read about in a travel book. He declined Ernst Hecht's invitation to dinner. Harry wanted to be alone. Thinking of Roya, he was not entirely alone. He'd even chosen a hotel that he thought Roya would have liked. Although it was not the most expensive hotel in Zurich, it was too expensive for a cop. But Harry had traveled so little that he'd saved a fair amount of money. He didn't expect the second district to pay for his room at the Hotel zum Storchen, not even for one night. Yet that was where he wanted to stay. It was a charmingly romantic hotel on the bank of the Limmat, and Harry chose a room that looked across the river at the floodlit Rathaus. Harry took himself to dinner at the Kronenhalle, across the Limmat. Thomas Mann had eaten there, and James Joyce. There were two dining rooms with original paintings by Klee, Chagall, Matisse, Miró, Picasso. Roya wouldn't have cared, but she would have liked the Budnerfleisch and the shredded calf's liver with Rösti. Harry usually drank nothing stronger than beer, but that night at the Kronenhalle, he had 4 beers and a whole bottle of red wine by himself. He was drunk when he returned to his hotel room. He fell asleep with his shoes on, and only the phone call from Nico Janssen forced him to wake up and properly undress for bed. "Tell me about it," Janssen said. "It's finished, right?" "I'm drunk, Nico," Harry replied. "I was asleep." "Tell me about it anyway," Nico Janssen said. "The bastard killed 8 hookers, each one in a different city, right?" "That's right. He'll be dead in a couple of weeks, his doctor told me," Harry said. "He has a lung infection. He's had emphysema for 15 years. It sounds like asthma, I guess." "You seem cheerful," Janssen said. "I'm drunk," Harry repeated. "You should be a happy drunk, Harry," Nico told him. "It's finished, right?" "All but the witness," Harry Hoekstra said. "You and your witness," Janssen said. "Let her go. We don't need her anymore." "But I saw her," Harry said. He didn't realize until he said it, but it was because he'd seen her that he couldn't get her out of his head. What had she been doing? She'd been a better witness than she probably knew, Harry thought. But all he said to Nico Janssen was, "I just want to congratulate her." "Jesus, you are drunk," Janssen told him. Harry tried to read in bed, but he was too drunk to comprehend what he was reading. The novel, which had been halfway decent airplane reading, was too challenging to read when he'd been drinking. It was the new novel by Alice Somerset, her 4th. It would be the last of her Margaret McDermid detective novels. The title was McDermid Retired. Notwithstanding his usual disdain for crime fiction, Harry Hoekstra was a big fan of the elderly Canadian author. While Eddie O'Hare would never have thought of 72 as elderly, that's how old Alice Somerset, alias Marion Cole, was in April of 91. Harry liked the so-called Margaret McDermid mysteries because he thought that the missing persons detective possessed a convincingly accurate amount of melancholy for a cop. Also, Alice Somerset's novels weren't really mysteries. They were psychological investigations into the mind of a lonely policewoman. For Harry, the novels believably demonstrated the effect of those missing persons on Detective Sergeant McDermid, meaning, of course, those missing persons whom the detective could never find. Although at the time Harry was at least 4.5 years away from retiring, it didn't help him to read about a policewoman who had retired.
especially since the point of the novel was that even after she'd retired, Detective Sergeant McDermott went on thinking like a cop. She becomes a prisoner of those photographs of the forever missing American boys. She can't bring herself to destroy the photos, even though she knows the boys will never be found. One day she would find the courage to destroy them, she hoped. That was the end of the novel. She hoped? Harry thought. That's it? She just hoped? Shit. What kind of an ending was that? Thoroughly depressed and still awake, Harry looked at the author photo. He was irritated that you could never get a good idea of what Alice Somerset looked like. There was the matter of her face, turned away, and she always wore a hat. The hat really pissed Harry off. A nom de plume was one thing, but what was she, a criminal? And because Harry couldn't get a good look at Alice Somerset's face, her hidden face reminded him of his missing witness. He'd not got a good look at her face either. Naturally, he'd noticed her breasts, and there'd been an attitude of alertness to her whole body, but what had also impressed him was the way she'd seemed to study everything. That was part of the reason he'd been drawn to study her. Harry realized that it wasn't only because she was the witness that he wanted to see her again. Whoever she was a woman he wanted to meet. That April of 91, when the newspapers in Amsterdam carried the story of the capture of the prostitute killer, there was something anticlimactic about the murderer being deathly ill. Urs Messerli would never leave the Universitätsspital. He would die that same month. A serial killer of as many as 8 prostitutes should have generated more of a sensation. But the story was headline news for less than a week. By the end of May, it was gone from the news altogether. Martin Schouten, Ruth Cole's Dutch publisher, was attending the Bologna Book Fair in Italy when the story broke. It was not news in Italy because none of the murdered prostitutes had been Italian. And from Bologna, every year, Martin traveled to New York. Now that their boys were grown up, Sylvia went with him to both places. And because Martin and Sylvia missed the news about finding Royo's killer, Ruth missed hearing about it too. She would go on thinking that the mole man had got away with it, that he was still out there. It was 4.5 years later, in the fall of 1995, when Harry Hoekstra, who was pushing 58 and almost retired, saw the new Ruth Cole novel in the window of that bookshop on the Spau, the Athenaeum. He immediately bought it. "It's about time she wrote another novel," Sergeant Hoekstra said to the salesgirl. All the booksellers in the Athenaeum knew Harry. His fondness for Ruth Cole's novels was nearly as familiar to them as the gossip that Sergeant Hoekstra had met more of his girlfriends in the Athenaeum while browsing for books than he'd met anywhere else. The booksellers at the Athenaeum liked to tease him. While they didn't doubt his fondness for reading travel books and novels, they also enjoyed telling the sergeant that they suspected he came to their bookshop not only to read. My Last Bad Boyfriend, which Harry bought in English, had a god-awful title in Dutch, Mijn Laatste Slechte Vriend. The salesgirl who waited on Harry, and who was quite a knowledgeable young bookseller, explained to him the possible reasons why Ruth Cole had needed 5 years to write what didn't appear to be a very long book. "It's her first novel in the first-person voice," the young bookseller began. "And I understand she had a baby a few years ago." "I didn't know she was married," Harry said, looking more closely at Ruth's jacket photo. She didn't look married, Harry thought. "Then her husband died about a year ago," the bookseller said. "So Ruth Cole was a widow," Sergeant Hoekstra supposed. He studied the author photo. "Yes, she looked more like a widow than she looked married. There was something sad in one of her eyes, or else it was some kind of flaw." She stared warily at the camera, as if her anxiety were an even more permanent part of her than her grief.
and to think that Ruth Cole's previous novel was about a widow. And now she is one, Sergeant Hoekstra thought.
The trouble with author photos, Harry mused, was that they were always so posed. And the authors never seemed to know what to do with their hands. There were a lot of clasped hands and folded arms and hands in pockets. There were hands on chins and hands in the hair. They should just keep their hands by their sides or in their laps, Harry believed. The other problem with author photos was that they were often composed of no more than heads and shoulders. Harry wanted to see what the writers' bodies looked like. In Ruth's case, you couldn't even see her breasts. On his days off, Harry often left the Athenaeum and sat reading in one of those cafes on the Spau, but he felt inclined to read Ruth Cole at home. That week he'd worked on a Friday from 8 in the evening until 4 the following morning. Saturday he'd worked from 3 in the afternoon until 11 at night. Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday he'd worked from 9 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. Now it was Wednesday, which he had off. He had Thursday off, too. On Friday he'd start up again. What could be better? A new Ruth Cole novel and 2 days off. When he got to the part of the story about an older woman with a younger man, he was disappointed. Harry was almost 58. He didn't want to read about a woman in her 30s with a younger man. Nevertheless, Harry was intrigued by the Amsterdam setting, and when he got to the part about the younger man persuading the older woman to pay a prostitute to watch her with a customer, aha! One can imagine Sergeant Hoekstra's surprise. It was a room all in red, which the stained glass lampshade made redder, Ruth Cole had written. Harry knew the room she had in mind.
I was so nervous that I wasn't of much use, Ruth Cole wrote. I couldn't even help the prostitute turn the shoe's toes out. I picked up only one of the shoes and I promptly dropped it. The prostitute scolded me for being such a nuisance to her. She told me to hide myself behind the curtain. Then she lined up the rest of the shoes on either side of my own. I suppose my own shoes must have been moving a little because I was trembling. Harry could imagine her trembling all right. He marked the place in the novel where he stopped reading. He would finish the book tomorrow. It was already late at night, but what did it matter? He had the whole next day off. Sergeant Hoekstra rode his bicycle from the west of Amsterdam to De Valen in record time. He'd paused only to take a pair of scissors and remove Ruth Cole's photo from the book jacket. There was no reason for anyone else to know who his witness was. He found the 2 fat women from Ghana first. When he showed them the picture, Harry had to remind them of the mystery woman from the United States who'd paused on the Stoofsteeg and asked them where they were from.
That was a long time ago, Harry, one of the women said.
5 years, he said. Is it her? The prostitutes from Ghana stared at the photograph.
You can't see her breasts, one of them said.
Yeah, she had nice breasts, the other one said.
Is it her? Harry asked them again.
It's been 5 years, Harry, the first one said.
Yeah, it's been too long, the other one said.
Harry next found the young, heavy-set Thai prostitute on the Bondesteeg. The older one, the sadist, was asleep, but Harry had more trust in the younger prostitute's judgment anyway.
Is it her? He asked again.
It could be,
the Thai slowly said.
I remember the boy better.
2 younger policemen in uniform were on the Gordijnensteeg, breaking up a brawl outside one of the Ecuadorians' window rooms. There was always a lot of fighting where the Ecuadorian transvestites were. In another year, they would all be deported. They'd been deported from France a few years ago. The young cop seemed surprised to see Sergeant Hoekstra. They knew he had the night off. But Harry told them he had a little business to attend to with the man with the rock-hard breasts the size of baseballs. The Ecuadorian transvestite sighed deeply when he looked at Ruth Cole's picture.
"It's a pity you can't see her breasts. She had nice ones," he told Harry.
"Then it's her. You're sure?" Harry asked him.
"She looks older,"
the prostitute said with disappointment.
"She is older," Harry knew. "And she'd had a baby. And her husband had died. There was a lot to account for why Ruth Cole looked older."
Harry couldn't find the Jamaican prostitute who'd led Ruth by her arm out of the Schlapperstech. She was the one who said that Harry's witness had a strong right arm for such a small woman. "Is she some kind of athlete?" Harry was thinking. The Jamaican prostitute was sometimes missing for a week or more at a time. She must have had some other life that was giving her a hard time, maybe in Jamaica. But it didn't matter. Harry didn't need to see her anyway. He pedaled his bicycle over to the Bergstraat last. He had to wait for Annika Smeets to be finished with a customer. Roya had left her window room to Annika in her will. It had probably helped to keep the overweight young woman off heroin. But the luxury of Annika owning Roya's room had done a lot of damage to Annika's diet. She was too fat to fit in the leather halter top anymore. "I want to come in," Harry told Annika, although he generally preferred to talk to her in the open air of the street. He had never liked how Annika smelled. And it was now very late at night. Annika smelled awful when she was ready to call it quits and go home. "Is this a business call, Harry?" the overweight young woman asked. "Your business or mine?" Sergeant Hoekstra showed her the author photo.
"That's her. Who is she?"
Annika asked. "Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. It's her. But what do you want with her? You've got the killer."
"Good night, Annika," Harry said. But when he stepped outside on the Bergstraat, he saw that someone had stolen his bicycle. This small disappointment was in the nature of the missing Jamaican prostitute being missing again. What did it really matter? Harry had the whole day off tomorrow, time enough to finish Ruth Cole's new novel and buy a new bicycle. There were no more than 20 or 30 murders in Amsterdam a year, most of them not domestic, but whenever the police dragged one of the canals looking for a missing body, they found hundreds of bicycles. Harry couldn't have cared less about his stolen bicycle.
Near the Hotel Bryan, on the Sengel, there were girls in window rooms where there had never been girls in the windows before.
More illegals. But Harry was off duty. He left the girls alone and went into the Bryan to ask the man at the reception desk to call him a taxi. In a year's time, the police would crack down on the illegals. Soon there would be empty window rooms around the red light district. Maybe Dutch women would once more be working in the windows. But by then Harry would be retired. It hardly mattered to him anymore. Back in his apartment, Harry built a fire in his bedroom. He couldn't wait to read the rest of Ruth Cole's novel. With some scotch tape, Sergeant Hoekstra stuck Ruth's author photo on the wall beside his bed. The firelight flickered there as he read into the night. He only occasionally got out of bed to build up the fire. In the flickering light, Ruth's anxious face seemed more alive to Harry than it had seemed on the back of her book. He could see her purposeful athletic walk, her alert presence in the red light district, where he'd followed her with at first fleeting, then renewed interest. She had nice breasts, Harry remembered. At last, 5 years after his friend's murder, Sergeant Hoekstra had found his witness. In which Eddie O'Hare falls in love again. As for Alice Somerset's fourth and apparently final Margaret McDermid mystery, McDermid retired, if Harry Hoekstra had been disappointed in the ending, Eddie O'Hare had been devastated. It was not merely what Marion had written about the photographs of her lost boys. One day she would find the courage to destroy them, she hoped. More depressing was the overall fatalism of the retired detective. Sergeant McDermid was resigned to the permanence of the boys being lost. even Marion's effort to breathe a fictional life into the death of her sons had deserted her. Alice Somerset sounded as if she were finished with writing. McDermid retired, struck Eddie O'Hare, as an announcement that the writer in Marion had retired too. At the time, all Ruth had said to Eddie was, "Lots of people retire before they're 72. But now, 4.5 years later, in the fall of 95, there'd been no word from Marion. Alice Somerset had not written, or at least not published, another book, and neither Eddie nor Ruth gave half as much thought to Marion as they used to. It sometimes seemed to Eddie that Ruth had written her mother off, and who could blame her? Ruth was unquestionably and deservedly angry that neither Graham's birth nor any of his subsequent birthdays had prompted an appearance from her mother. And Alan's death a year ago, which might have inspired Marion to come forward and offer her condolences, had resulted in another no-show. Although Alan had never been religious, he'd left very careful and specific instructions regarding what he wanted done in the event of his death. He wanted to be cremated, and he'd asked to have his ashes scattered in Kevin Merton's cornfield. Kevin, their Vermont neighbor and the caretaker for Ruth's house in her absence, had a lovely rolling cornfield. It was the principal view from Ruth's master bedroom. Alan hadn't considered that Kevin and his wife might object. The cornfield was not Ruth's property. But the Mertons had raised no objections. Kevin philosophized that Alan's ashes would be good for the cornfield. And Kevin had told Ruth that if he ever had to sell his farm, he would sell her or Graham the cornfield first. It was typical of Alan to have presumed on Kevin's kindness. As for the house in Sagaponack, in the year that followed Alan's death, Ruth would often think of selling it. Alan's memorial service was held at the New York Society for Ethical Culture on West 64th Street. His colleagues at Random House made all the arrangements. A fellow editor spoke first. A fond remembrance of Alan's often intimidating presence at the venerable publishing house. Then 4 of Alan's authors spoke. As his widow, Ruth was not among the speakers. She'd worn an unfamiliar hat with a more unfamiliar veil. The veil had frightened Graham. She'd needed to beg the 3-year-old's permission before he allowed her to wear it at all. The veil had seemed essential to her, not out of reverence or because of tradition, but to mask her tears. The majority of mourners and friends who'd come to pay their respects to Alan were of the opinion that the child clung to his mother throughout the service. But it was more the case that his mother clung to him. Ruth had held the 3-year-old on her lap. Her tears were probably more disturbing to him than was the reality of his father's death. At 3, his sense of death was inexact. After several pauses in the memorial service, Graham whispered to his mother, "Where is Daddy now?" It was as if, in the child's mind, his father were away on a journey. "It's going to be okay, baby," Hannah, who was seated next to Ruth, whispered throughout the service. This irreligious litany was a surprisingly welcome irritation to Ruth. It distracted her from her grief. The mindlessness of Hannah's repetition made Ruth wonder if Hannah thought she was consoling the child who'd lost his father or the woman who'd lost her husband. Eddie O'Hare had been the last to speak. Alan's colleagues had not chosen him, nor had Ruth. Given Alan's low opinion of Eddie as a writer and speaker, it frankly astonished Ruth that Alan had designated a role for Eddie at the memorial service. Just as Alan had chosen the music and the location, the latter for its non-religious atmosphere, and just as emphatically as Alan had insisted on no flowers, he'd always hated the smell of flowers, Alan had left instructions that Eddie should speak last. Alan had even told Eddie what to say. As always, Eddie was a little faltering. He fumbled about for some sort of introduction, which made it clear that Alan hadn't told him everything that he was supposed to say. Alan hadn't anticipated that he would die so young.
and he explained that at 52 he was only 6 years younger than Alan had been. This thought was evidently sobering to Eddie. Perhaps he was more concerned that he might die in his sleep some night soon than he was overcome with grief upon Alan's abrupt departure. But the age factor was important, Eddie struggled to say, because Alan had left instructions for Eddie to read a certain poem. Yeats's When You Are Old. What was embarrassing was that Alan had imagined that Ruth would already be an old woman when he died. He'd quite correctly presumed that, given the 18-year difference in their ages, he would die before she would. But, typical of Alan, he'd never imagined that he would die and leave his widow still a young woman. "Jesus, this is excruciating," Hannah had whispered to Ruth. "Eddie should just read the fucking poem." Ruth, who already knew the poem, would have been happier never to hear it. The poem always made her cry. Even removed from the contexts of Alan's death and Ruth herself being left a widow, she had no doubt that it would make her cry now. "It's going to be okay, baby," Hannah whispered again, as Eddie finally read the Yeats poem. "When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face." And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. Understandably, everyone in attendance presumed that Ruth cried so bitterly because of how much she'd loved her husband. She had loved Alan, or at least she'd learned to. But even more, Ruth had loved her life with him. And while it pained her that Graham had lost his father, it was at least better for Graham that the boy was young enough not to be permanently scarred. In time, Graham would hardly remember Alan at all. But Ruth had been so angry with Alan for dying. And when Eddie read the Yeats poem, it only made her angrier to hear how Alan had assumed she would be an old woman when he died. Ruth, of course, had always hoped she would be an old woman when Alan died. Now here she was, just turned 40, and with a 3-year-old son. And there was yet a meaner, more selfish reason for Ruth's tears. It was that reading Yeats had discouraged her from even trying to be a poet. Hers were the tears a writer cried whenever a writer heard something better than anything he or she could have written. "Why is Mommy crying?" Graham had asked Hannah for the 100th time, because Ruth had been on and off inconsolable since Alan's death. "Your mommy's crying because she misses your daddy," Hannah whispered to the child. "But where is Daddy now?" Graham asked Hannah. He'd not yet had a satisfactory answer from his mother. After the service, a crush of people had pressed around Ruth. She lost count of the number of times her arms were squeezed. She kept her hands clasped at her waist. Most people didn't try to touch her hands, just her wrists and her forearms and her upper arms. Hannah had carried Graham, Eddie slinking alongside them. Eddie looked especially sheepish, as if he regretted having read the poem, or else he was silently berating himself in the belief that his introduction should have been longer and clearer. "Take off the pail, Mommy," Graham had said. "It's a veil, baby, not a pail," Hannah told the boy. "And Mommy wants to keep it on." "No, I'll take it off now," Ruth said. She'd finally stopped crying. A numbness enclosed her face. She felt impervious to crying or to any form of showing how upset she was. Then she remembered that dreadful old woman who'd called herself a widow for the rest of her life. Where was she now? Alan's memorial service would have been the perfect place for her to reappear. "Do you remember that terrible old widow?" Ruth asked Hannah and Eddie. "I'm on the lookout for her, baby," Hannah had replied, "but she's probably dead." Eddie was still in the throes of being overcome by the Yeats poem, yet he'd never stopped being the constant observer. Ruth was looking for Marion, too. Then she thought she saw her mother. The woman wasn't old enough to be Marion, but Ruth didn't realize this at first. What struck Ruth was the woman's elegance, and what had seemed to be her heartfelt sympathy and concern. She was looking at Ruth not in a threatening or invasive way, but with both pity and an anxious curiosity. She was an attractive older woman, only Alan's age, not even 60. Also, the woman wasn't looking at Ruth at all as closely as she was looking at Hannah. That was when Ruth realized that the woman wasn't really looking at Hannah either. It was Graham who was drawing the woman's attention. Ruth touched the woman's arm and asked, "Excuse me, do I know you?" The woman, embarrassed, averted her eyes. But whatever had shamed her passed. She gathered her courage and squeezed Ruth's forearm. "I'm sorry. I know I was staring at your son. It's just that he doesn't look at all like Alan," the woman said nervously. "Who are you, lady?" Hannah asked her. "Oh, I'm sorry," the woman said to Ruth. "I'm the other Mrs. Albright. I mean the first Mrs. Albright." Ruth didn't want Hannah to be rude to Alan's ex-wife, and Hannah looked as if she were about to ask, "Were you invited?" Eddie O'Hare saved the day. "I'm so glad to meet you," Eddie said, squeezing the ex-wife's arm. "Alan always spoke so highly of you." The ex-Mrs. Albright was stunned. She was easily as overcome as Eddie had been by the Yeats poem. Ruth had never heard Alan speak highly of his ex-wife. Sometimes he'd spoken pityingly of her, specifically because he felt certain she would rue her decision never to have children. Now here she was, staring at Graham. Ruth was sure that the ex-Mrs. Albright had come to Alan's memorial service not to pay her respects to Alan, but to get a look at his child. But all Ruth said was, "Thank you for coming." She would have gone on, babbling insincerities, but Hannah stopped her. "Baby, you look better with the veil on," Hannah whispered. "Graham, this is an old friend of your daddy's," Hannah told the boy. "Say hello." "Hello," Graham said to Alan's ex-wife. "But where is Daddy? Where is he now?" Ruth slipped the veil back on. Her face felt so numb that she was unaware she was crying again. It was for children that one wanted heaven, Ruth thought. It was only for the sake of being able to say, "Daddy's in heaven, Graham," which was what she'd said then. "And heaven is nice, isn't it?" the boy began. They'd had many discussions of heaven and what it was like since Alan had died. Possibly, heaven meant more to the boy because the discussion of it was so new. As neither Ruth nor Alan was religious, heaven had not been a part of Graham's first 3 years on earth. "I'll tell you what heaven is like," the ex-Mrs. Albright said to the boy. "It's like your best dreams." But Graham was of an age where he more frequently had nightmares. Dreams were not necessarily heaven sent. Yet if the boy was to believe the Yeats poem, he would be forced to envision his daddy pacing the mountains overhead and hiding his face in a crowd of stars. "Is that heaven or a nightmare?" Ruth would wonder. "She's not here, is she?" Ruth suddenly said to Eddie through her veil. "I don't see her.
Eddie admitted.
"I know she's not here," Ruth said. "Who's not here?" Hannah asked Eddie.
"Her mother," Eddie replied.
"It's gonna be okay, baby," Hannah whispered to her best friend. "Fuck your mother."
In Hannah Grant's opinion, "Fuck Your Mother" would have been a more appropriate title for Eddie O'Hare's fifth novel, A Difficult Woman, which was published that same fall of 94 when Alan died. But Hannah had given up on Ruth's mother long ago, and, not yet being an older woman herself, at least not in her mind, Hannah was sick to death of Eddie's younger man with older woman theme. Hannah was 39, as Eddie had pointed out, exactly the age Marion had been when he'd fallen in love with her.
"Yeah, but you were 16, Eddie," Hannah reminded him. "That's one category I've eliminated from my sexual lexicon. I mean, fucking teenagers."
While Hannah had accepted Eddie as Ruth's newfound friend, there was more about Eddie that troubled Hannah than the natural jealousy that friends often feel for friends of friends. She'd had boyfriends who were Eddie's age and older. Eddie was 52 in the fall of 94. And while Eddie was hardly Hannah's cup of tea, he was nonetheless a physically attractive older man who was not a homosexual. Yet he'd never made a pass at her. Hannah found this more than troubling.
"Look, I like Eddie," she would say to Ruth, "but you've got to admit that there's something wrong with the guy."
What Hannah found wrong was that Eddie had eliminated younger women from his sexual lexicon. Ruth still found Hannah's sexual lexicon more disturbing than Eddie's. If Eddie's enduring attraction to older women was weird, at least it was weird in a selective way.
"I suppose I'm some kind of sexual shotgun. Is that what you mean?" Hannah asked.
"Different folks, different strokes," Ruth replied tactfully.
"Look, baby, I saw Eddie on Park Avenue in 89th. He was pushing an old woman in a wheelchair," Hannah said. "I also saw him one night in the Russian tea room. He was with an old lady in a neck brace."
They might have had accidents. "They didn't necessarily succumb to old age," Ruth responded. "Young women break their legs. The one in the wheelchair might have been skiing. There are automobile accidents. There's always whiplash."
"Baby," Hannah pleaded. "This old woman was confined to a wheelchair, and the one with the neck brace was a walking skeleton. Her neck was too thin to hold up her head."
"I think Eddie's sweet," was all Ruth would say. "You're going to get old too, Hannah. Wouldn't you like to have someone like Eddie in your life then?" But even Ruth had to confess that she found A Difficult Woman a serious stretch of the so-called willing suspension of her disbelief. A man in his early 50s, who bears remarkable similarities to Eddie, is the doting lover of a woman in her late 70s. They make love amid a daunting host of medical precautions and uncertainties. Not surprisingly, they meet in a doctor's office, where the man is anxiously awaiting his first sigmoidoscopy.
"What are you here for?" the older woman asks the younger man. "You look healthy enough."
The younger man admits his anxiety concerning the procedure he is about to undergo.
"Oh, don't be silly," the older woman tells him. "Heterosexual men are such cowards when it comes to being penetrated. There's really nothing to it. I must have had half a dozen sigmoidoscopies. Mind you, be prepared. They do give you a little gas."
A few days later, the two encounter each other at a cocktail party. The older woman is so beautifully dressed that the younger man doesn't recognize her. Moreover, she approaches him in an alarmingly coquettish manner.
"I last saw you when you were about to be penetrated," she whispers to him. "How'd it go?"
Stammering, he replies, "Oh, very well, thank you. And you were right, it was nothing to be afraid of."
"I'll show you something to be afraid of."
the woman whispers to him, which begins their disturbingly passionate love story, which is over only when the older woman dies. "For God's sake," Alan had said to Ruth about Eddie's fifth novel, "you've got to hand it to O'Hare. Nothing embarrasses him."